Welcome to the Yeshiva Shalmaila. This is David Lichtenstein. I think the Yeshiva Shalmaila is the widest reaching shiur in the world. We get any place between, 25 and 40,000 listens to each program. And that's a real wonderful shiur. And we hope you enjoy it. And we hope you're learning from it. You can certainly make Birchas HaTorah before you listen. So this week, our topic is going to be a very painful and yet relevant topic. Most of the harugim, the soldiers in battle, are bachrim. Reservists, married people, are usually, held back unless they're really, professional captains or generals, etc. But the vast majority of the harugim are bachrim. Some of them are single childs, a ben yachid. And now, medically, we have the ability to take zera out of the mace as long as 3 days after he was killed. And parents are saying, hey, let me take Zera, lahakim lebaneinu shem, like it says by Yibum. So it's sort of like a Yibum shayla. It's obviously not a halachic shayla of Yibum, but the same concept. Let them be a zikarin for this person, lachamisa. So, but there are many shaylas and questions. And I've heard from the Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael that there are 100 parents have made this request. So most of the Rabbanim we spoke to said that the Medina, a lot of them work for the Rabbanut or for other organizations, so then they can't come on the year and discuss it because it's psak that is actually occurring as we speak. And here are the shilas. Is it permitted? Is it forbidden? Or is it a mitzvah? Is it a question? If they did do it and they implanted it into Anisha and she was mylid, would the mace be mekayim pru revu? Can you be mekayim a mitzvah lachar misa? Would it exempt somebody from chalitza? Now, here are some of the problems. Is it a problem of nivul hames? You're not allowed to desecrate a body. Let's say if an autopsy would be permitted, it would only be permitted b'makams where it was pikuach nefesh. If organs were removed, it would have to be b'makam pikuach nefesh because of the law of nivul hames. Is there an issue of hanah min hames? Certainly hanah if you're getting a child. Hanah min hames is aser. Is there a problem of bitul mitzvahs kfura? Right? Delaying of mitzvahs kfura of halana sameis because it would take a few days off into procedure. They can't do it on the spot. Are there moral issues? We're going to have Reb Shlomo Brody. He's a renowned lecturer, author, Mechaber Sfarim, Paisik, who is paskening on the shilas. Now we're going to have a lawyer, an attorney in Israel by the name of Irit Rosenblum. She's the founder and executive director of New Family, and she is the legal expert in Israel who litigates this topic because many cases it ends up where there are disparate opinions. One famous case was where a Ben Yachid was killed in the army, and the parents wanted to be Maiti Zera, and the Almana, who since remarried and actually had her own children, said, I don't want my husband, even though she had remarried, to have children without me. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court in Israel. And there are questions of the court has to litigate. All the sperm banks in Israel are owned by the government. And the government has an issue that can you do something without the consent of the mace? Most often they hadn't imagined this would happen to them. So she'll give us, what's going on from the legal point of view in Israel. And then we'll have the director of PUA, which is the organization there at Yisrael that deals with all, period of arrivia, women's issues, Rabbi Gideon Weitzman, to opine on this as well. Should make for a very fascinating shaila. Before we go to our program, I want to say a vart. And again, as always, I ask you, Rabbi, you can agree or disagree and do it loudly. Why do Yidin argue so much? Yidin are always arguing. Our name, Ki Sarisa, Mali, Him V'Anashim V'Tuchel, is Sarisa means to argue, right? Jews are always arguing, famously arguing. I want to shtel, we just finished the whole story of the Egel. And the Yerushalmi in Tainus famously says, there is no generation, ein doyer, she'en bo chelik mechetei shel Egel. Every generation has a chelik of the chet of the Egel. And also, which is interesting, why? Like, where do you have the Egel in our generation? Additionally, it says about the chet Egel, it's the only chet that is nenash ledoyreis. It seems to be repeats itself and repeats itself and repeats itself. Those are my two questions. Why is the Egel so profound that it continues now? It's the only chet that seems to continue forever. Why do Jews argue so much? Let me shtel a possible thing. I heard a story. There were a bunch of maskilim. They very much wanted to see Rothschild. Rothschild Bismane, he was as wealthy as Bezos and Musk rolled into one. He financed wars for entire countries. And there was like a mystique about him. So a bunch of maskilim from Litha and Poilin got together, 25 of the smartest maskilim. They want to go see Rothschild just to get a glimpse of him. So they wrote a letter. They said, look, you'll be allowed into his castle, but you're not going to see him. He's much too busy to meet people. They said, okay. So they went to France, and they went to the beautiful Rothschild estate, and they were let in. And then they were given a tour of the little bit of the property, and then they hear a commotion. What? There's somebody coming out of his study. And everybody, wow, what an opportunity. Maybe they'll get to see him. Maybe they'll see his secretary. Who knows? A glimpse, a srid, and two very beautifully dressed liverymen march out of his study. And they're carrying on their shoulders a big silver box, beautiful silver box. And the door closes, and they, in a stately gait, they pass by this, you know, group of 25 people. And they were so nispoil from the, you know, the royalty of the liverymen and the gold, the silver box, that they all deeply bowed. Like, they didn't offer up to him, but they bowed deeply, and they stood up, and like, it was like a moment. Wow. Okay, they finished the review. When they were leaving the estate, they saw one of the liverymen. So one of them said, what was in it? Was it his books? Was it money? Was it gold bars? Maybe he had a piece of the loot. What was it? So the liveryman looked at him and said, no, that's his potty. This was before they had toilets in Europe at that period. That was his potty box. And this Moscow realized that they had all deeply bowed down in front of the potty of the feces of Rothschild. That's cool when somebody exchanges something meaningful for something counterfeit, something that's really Eile Elohecha Yisrael. They had the Luchais, they had a view of Har Sinai, of Eish, and then they had made an Egel Hazav, and they exchanged it for something counterfeit. And the question is, why is it L'chol Doir? Where in our lives are we exchanging the real for the counterfeit? It could be materiality, it could be wealth, could be social status. What's your counterfeit God? Is it power? Is it technology? Are you on your iPhone all day? Is it social media? Is it politics? Are you like, when you get wrapped up, like, is Trump your new Elohecha Yisrael or Biden? Either one. Is it beauty? Is it real gashmias? Is it food? Is it addictions? So why do Jews argue so much? Because we want the truth. We learned from the beginning, don't mistake the real thing for an Egel Hazav. There was a writer, a French writer, wrote a story called The Necklace. And I remember when I read it, I was so shaken. It's a story about a girl, a pretty girl, and she marries a very nice boy, a simple boy. He's an accountant, and he earns a nice living, and they live a humble, nice life. And she's always yearning for something more. And then she gets invited to a very fancy upper-class party. And her husband comes home one day, and she's sitting in her chair. She's crying. He says, well, he says, I would love to go, but I don't have a dress, and they're expensive. Her husband thinks, he says, you know, I could agree to work the next 3 months on Sundays, and they'll pay me in advance, and with that, you could buy a dress. Her husband loved her, and he went into the boss. He said, I'll work an extra 15 or 20 Sundays, whatever, and he gave her the money. So she got on there. Then she realized she didn't have jewelry to wear to this upper-class party, and she realized that's way too expensive for her husband to raise the money for. So she had one rich friend, and she went to the friend. She said, do you have a beautiful husband? Her friend said, yeah, he has a beautiful necklace, and she gives her like a diamond necklace. Gorgeous. And she put on the necklace and she went to the party, and it was the best party of her life. She was the star of the party, and she laughed and she danced, and people looked at her and she said witty things. It was incredible. And she came home, and as she was getting undressed, she put her hand up to take off the necklace, and she realized the necklace had slipped off her neck, and she had like a heart attack. The necklace was a fortune. She went back to the party and she searched it. She couldn't find it. She has to go back and give back to her friend. So she goes to the jeweler and she tells her husband the story. And there's something that looks really like that necklace, almost indistinguishable. And it's 40,000 francs. It's more than her husband makes in 5 years. And they had no choice. So they mortgaged their house. And she took, with the money, they bought the necklace. She brought it back to her friend. Her friend didn't even look at it. She just, rich friend, just took it, stuck it in its case, put it back in the drawer, boom. And she took 3 jobs, this woman, to pay it off. And she spent the next 20 years paying off for that necklace. 20 years later, she sees her friend, and her friend says, you know, you look so much older. You aged. Like, I guess she was an honest, too honest person. And she tells her friend, well, I'll tell you why. I didn't tell you. I lost your necklace, and I replaced it with another one, and I spent the last 20 years paying it off. And her friend looks shocked. She turns white. She opens her mouth, and she said, the necklace I gave you was costume jewelry. It wasn't real. She had spent her life working for something that was totally false. And I just look at myself and I think we all have to look at each other and we say, what in our life is really counterfeit? What are we serving? What Eloi Elohecha Yisrael are we saying? That one day we're going to look back and we say, you know, it wasn't real. Why did I do it? Like, I don't even care. Nobody cares. And that's the chait of the egel. That's how we can really ruin our life. And that's what it says. The chait of the egel is every generation. And there's no einish that doesn't have a piece of it. And what does that mean? Not necessarily that the Rabbeinu Shalom is vindictive and but that lesson we should have learned. Why are we still paying for things that are costume jewelry? Why are we still standing up for somebody's potty? And that, to me, is the message of the egel. And if we could take that message into our own hearts, think of how much happier we could be without the 20 years of work, without the hispilus for all those false things. So the story of the egel can really enrich me and you if we take it to heart. Let's go to our riddles of the week. So Purim is coming up. I'm going to do three riddles. The fast riddles, the fun. Drama in Simin Nun Hei, that's an Archaim Aleph, Paskins, that somebody who's born in the first in Adar, and then he gets his bar mitzvah, is in a year that there's two Adars. So when should his bar mitzvah be? The first Adar or the second Adar? So the bar mitzvah is the second Adar. The Rama seems to hold that the second Adar is the real Adar, which is the Lashonis of certain Rishonim, Adar, Akar of Lanisan, etc. That's the real thing. The first Adar was, oops, a mistake. The problem is the Rama. And here's in Taf Kuf Samaches, Sav Zayin, that by a yahrzeit, that if somebody's father's yahrzeit is on Adar, what do you do in Mishnas Muberes when it comes to Tainus? You do the yahrzeit in the first Adar and not in the second Adar. So you see from there that the first Adar is the real one. Well, by a bar mitzvah, he says the second Adar is real. By a yahrzeit, he says the first Adar is real. Two Ramaz in Shulchan Aruch, we gave you the simanim. Well, make up your mind. Hagoyin Ramois Ishalis, which one is it? The first Adar or the second Adar? By the way, that he was called the Moshe Rabbeinu. The Ramo was called, the Moshe Rabbeinu of the Eden of Poland and Litta. That's how he was, you know. Okay, here's the next one. The Shulchan Aruch and Tafresh Sadik Vav Ches says, you could get married on Purim, which is a good thing. Somebody can't afford a Suda. He could combine his Suda's Purim into his Chasana Suda. So the problem is that we know there's a klal by all Mayadim, all other Yom Tovim, you don't marry women, you don't get married. Why? Because Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha. It's not respectful, right? It dilutes a Simcha to compound it with another Simcha. This goes into Midas, right? So Purim is also a day of Simcha. Yimei Mishta V'Simcha, it says in Megillah, that they were Kaveh. So if it's a Yom of Simcha, and we have a klal by all other Yom Tovim of Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha, why is Purim different? And you can't get married on Purim. That is our second riddle. And our third riddle is a very simple one. Every mitzvah, even a drabanan, we make a bracha. Lad likner shel Chanukah. Well, mitzvahs we even make a bracha on the kriyas halal. I mean, it's just a minig drabanan, which is halal on Rosh Chodesh. Well, mishleach manes, which is much more than a drabanan, is divrei seifrim. It precedes both Chanukah and Chanukah, and it precedes Rosh Chodesh, because it's divrei seifrim, right? It's Esther is one of the ksuvim, right? Why don't you make a bracha before you send shalach manes, baruch ato Hashem, shenu tzei senu, al mishleach manes, and hand it to your friend, or give it to the shliach to give to your friend. Or have the shliach maybe make the bracha before he hands it over if you don't do it yourself. Those are our three riddles. If you want to leave a message by phone or dial in by phone to listen, in America, our number is 732-806-8700. In England, it's 44, like that's the country code, 33-011-70250. In Eretz Yisrael, it's 02-372-0304. Let's go to our wonderful guest.
Joining us from Yerushalayim is Rabbi Shlomo Brody. He's a renowned lecturer and author, in particular on end-of-life issues. He's the executive director of Emasai, which is about end-of-life and organ donation. He's written a safe recently, Ethics of Our Fighters, you understand, in a time of war what this means. He was for many years a Rebbe in Yeshiva Sakaisel. He's a musmach of Rav Lichtenstein, Zechatalik Lavracha. Welcome, Rabbi Brody.
Great to be back with you.
Sorry, Brody, question. I heard that there have been over 100 requests from parents of killed soldiers. I would imagine the majority of them, Rahman al-Islam al-Bakhram, who don't have any children, of parents who want to remove the zera from the soldier so that maybe at a later date they'll find a woman who wants to be impregnated with the zera and be make him shem for this child, almost like a modern-day version of Yibum, right? Like it says by Yibum, right?
Yeah.
And I wanted to know the pros and the cons. Like, honestly, to me, it is such a clear, there's so much clear benefit from it. I want to sort of hear those who are opposed to it, why, and what, you know, what are the pros and what are your opinions? And I have some other questions about organ donation, actually. So let's start with that.
Okay, absolutely. So some of the cases are dealing with single soldiers who unfortunately were killed before they had a family or got married. Some of the cases have been dealing with married soldiers who sometimes had one kid, sometimes had no kids, and their wives, their widows, want to take the zera and bring them a child. And those cases are actually quite different on many levels. Because in one case, you have a situation where a woman says, we're married, we had intent to raise a family, and I want to fulfill our dreams and our desire of a very natural desire to bring a zera to this world and to continue his line, so to speak. The second type of case, which deals with a single person, is much more complicated because we're dealing with someone where, you know, who's going to be the mom here? Who's going to raise this child? What's the connection here? And I think it, in many ways, that's one of the big issues that people worry about is, are we in practice encouraging, even with good intents, let's say, of the parents, but are we encouraging, in fact, here a situation where we're bringing a child to the world who has no connection to the father, and possibly not even to the mother had no connection as well to the father. And is this really a great service to the father or to the world to do such a thing?
So in effect, you're bringing it's a very valid point. You're bringing an orphan into the world who will be a yasim me'av u'me'em in a certain level, because the mother who's bearing him, the surrogate, may not feel much of a connection to him.
Well, hopefully the mother will feel some form of connection, but certainly won't feel a connection to the father per se, right? Not necessarily anyway.
Well, that's why is that important then? Why is that important at all?
Well, you have to ask if you want to have that type of world where you have single women in general, right, taking zera and bringing children into the world. In some ways relates to that more general question as well. There might be no formal isur, of course, but you could say that essentially we're taking a woman who has no connection to the father and bringing children into the world in this case. So that's, I think, part of the bigger question here at stake. And by the way, it's interesting that in some countries around the world, it's simply illegal. You can't use the zera of a single man after he's passed away. It's illegal for that reason, I think. And broader ethical questions along those lines. So, of course, the natural intuition, I agree with you, is understandable. But I think that many are opposed, including many poskim, who are opposed to this idea because of these concerns.
What happens if you have younger grandparents who want to bring up the child?
So you could argue that this is sort of a situation of like Naomi, right, in Sefer Ruth, where you have this situation where you have this type of spirit, and you could say that's possible. And Israeli courts, at least in a couple of cases, have found that they will allow the younger grandparents to raise this child. I still think that raises some of the issues. I mean, I hear the argument, of course, but I still think it raises some of the issues if this is really the type of scenario that we want to be encouraging. Rav Asher Weiss has a tshuva on the topic. It was an interesting case of a young man who died, unfortunately, from cancer, and they had procured his zera beforehand. And Rav Asher states simply, there's no kiyum mitzvot once a person has died, and this is in the way that we intend to bring children into the world.
I agree. It doesn't make a lot of sense if there's no relative here who really passionately wants it just to do a mitzvah. There's no mitzvah yibam of Lo'imach HaShmai in such a situation, clearly, right? However, if you have grandparents who are interested because they want to have a memory of their child and they're still young enough, I mean, there was just a story recently about a Rosh Hashiva in Eretz Yisrael who had a child, he's 88, and everybody's dancing and giving mazel tov. Well, if an 88-year-old could have a child, you have a lot of grandparents that are in their 50s, right? You could even have grandparents in their 40s who would certainly want to be parents to their own zera should be laying machash ma'ab Yisrael, maybe an only child, right?
There's who
would
want to
bring that. So in such a case, I don't know the case of Reb Asha, but if there's take if it was an only child and you have grandparents who are young enough and could afford it and they want to have a continuation of their lineage, right, or of their son's lineage, and they could do it, like, why wouldn't, in such a case, what would be the objection? Nobody wants to bring an unwanted child into the world. We would agree on that, I guess. But if it's a wanted child, such as a case that I said, what would the Rabbanim say in such a situation?
There's understandable ratzon here to bring a zera on a lineage and a sort of, or you might call the modern yibum. One of the concerns is how long is this going to last for on a practical level, meaning it's a big deal to make that type of decision as grandparents to bring a child into the world. I think the law, by the way, in Israel is that while you can preserve the zera immediately, of course, you have to, but you can't use it for at least a year because you want to give people a little bit of time to make sure this is something that they actually want to get done. So that's always one concern. And once again, the question is, I mean, don't get me wrong. There are many times when we have tragedies. A young father can pass away. Even both parents can pass away. And grandparents, someone else can raise the child and beautifully raise the child. But the question is, in general, do we want to have that type of use of zera with bringing into the world situation, kids in a situation without a mother and a father?
Now, here's another, this is such a social more than a halachic issue, but a lot of times you have older single women who have nobody to marry them, that they want to have kids desperately. So if they could have a child and carry a child of a dead soldier, it could be for them very meaningful, though.
Definitely could be very meaningful for the woman, for the deceased and for the grandparents, and it's even better than a normal case because then you'll have involved grandparents, hopefully, from the side of the deceased father. That's certainly preferable than much of what goes on, but you see the poskim are against, in general, using IVF to impregnate single women. And since one of the great dayanim of Yerushalayim, of Duchovsky, Shlita, has stated, it said, listen, I can't tell you that it's formally usher. There's no formal prohibition of doing this. But I think on a public policy level, this isn't something you want to encourage. Maybe this is a little bit different. You could argue why this is a little bit different, but I can see both sides here. This is very sensitive.
I mean, we had on actually a panel of Rabbanim, Reb David Cohn and Reb Mendel Shafran and Reb Herschel Schechter about this issue. And they were all opposed, not halachically, but again, socially. Like, do you want to have an older single girl with a child? And this is, again, this is not a halachic debate, really, but, and Reb David Cohn said you bring a yasim into the world. But my feeling is that, you have an older single. If I was an older single woman, I was 40 years old, and nobody wanted to marry me. We just weren't the wrong guys, right? And I could die alone in a nursing home. And I would make the argument, I'm going to be a fantastic mother. And you say, well, if there's no father, well, why don't we stop people who have anger issues from having children? We don't stop people who are total oyutzlach, who can't earn a living, and the family's always hungry from having a living. We don't have people who are licentious from having children. I mean, there's so many issues, serious depression parents from having parents. Why would we just, and we don't rule on any of those, and yet people come out so vociferously against a single mother who's done nothing wrong in her life and says, I'm going to be the greatest mother, and I have a good job, and I could afford it, and my parents are going to love this child. And over here we're saying, no, we won't allow it. Like, just from a social point of view, like, or the 14th child, or the 15th child of a family that really can't afford it, nobody says a word. It's a mitzvah to have children. And yet everybody comes down on this person who wants one child and doesn't want to die alone and wants to be a great parent. Like, how do we create that barrier of who yes to come down on and who not to come down on?
So I think it's a great question. In fact, Rav Duchovsky in his essay on this topic says it could be in a different generation we'll change our minds on this issue. I think part of what's going on here is much of the opposition relates to the general culture and the culture which is no longer values the same way it once did, having children raised by two parents and preferably two parents that are married to each other. And you might argue that this is the wrong example, wrong case to put your foot down against the phenomenon when so many other phenomena are going around. I think we all know that there can be many single women who can be wonderful mothers and raise wonderful children in this world and be helped by parents and family and their neighbors and whatnot. And certainly in this case, I think we understand why we've been more sympathetic to allowing such an action, because we want to give the deceased soldier that bracha of having a zera to continue on. Rav Mordechai Halperin is one of the great Shari Tzedek. So he has an argument along this line. He says this is a great act of Gemilut Chasadim. And, you know, we have this idea of saying that a son can be Ben Mizaka Av, and this is a great chesed. And you can make such an argument, there's no doubt. Rav Zalman Nechemia also has a very interesting argument on this issue, and where he says, if I can't find a Mefurish Isser.
You can't ask for something.
That's right. The burden of proof is on those who want to say it's Usser. If it's not Usser, you know, based on the statement of Tiferet Yisrael and Mishnah Nidai.
Yeah.
I'm sympathetic on both sides here. That's why I think this is a big debate. And we understand why it's a complex issue.
And let me add on a few nakudas here. I think that a single mother having a child living in Bnei Brak or Borough Park or Lakewood would be an absolute disaster, right? But there are different communities that are, you know, would be more understanding. It's also possible that a mother giving birth to a soldier son would be more, there would be more acceptance because of the recognition of the mitzvah or quasi mitzvah, whatever you want, the gemilas chasad, the sodom that is happening here. So I think it's like all of the rabbanim I had on pretty much said it's, there's no halachic issue here. It's just they felt for social reasons, and it would be a question of judging each social reason, you know, on a one-off basis, iteratively, and saying in this case, are you embarrassing the child? Would you not be embarrassing the child? Where is it in the community? How would people look at this child? Do they see it as the death, the son of somebody who died, basically, what's accepted al Kiddush Hashem? So I think that it's very case-by-case specific. Would you think so or no?
I think that's true, but, you know, when you're trying to give general statements of policy and what you're trying to encourage, it's hard to be case-by-case. But there's no doubt that in many social circumstances, it would be accepted, and certainly the child would be loved, and you might even say be embraced, precisely because of the situation. Listen, we have cases already now where soldiers died with pregnant wives, and of course, a little bit different in the scenario, but the community is pledged, and I'm sure they're going to keep to this pledge, to help the mother, you know, raise this child, and, you know, bring this a great tzaddik of a child, a tzaddiket. So you could make that argument as well. By the way, even in Bnei Brak is such a strong social, you know, network, where people help each other. I think it could be acceptable there as well, the same way sometimes we have this in, you know, unfortunate tragedies. So I agree on the case-by-case level. I certainly, you know, would want to judge it that way. And, of course, if in practice someone makes this choice, the same way when someone, a single woman makes this choice, we should love and care for the child and help as much as possible once this child is brought into the world.
Now, here's a few, let me throw a few ideas at you. The Paiskim, earlier Paiskim, the Binyamin Zev, you're talking about 1700s, writes, Ein schus hakrevim mayel, ela schus haben la'av, ugabe kaddish. That the real kaddish that counts is the kaddish of a son for a father. And the Zeruah says a similar thing. So I wonder, would a reason be to say that it'll be a while, but one day this son, at least on the yard site, will say kaddish, somebody will say kaddish for his father, whereas otherwise this would never happen. What do you think of that as an argument?
Sure, you can make that argument, and it's not just for kaddish, it's all for many other zchiyot as well. But, you know, we've had many centuries in which we didn't have this phenomenon, and I don't think that we think that because of that, the deceased, per se, don't have those who are going to be, say, kaddish for them, or those who can do zchiyot for them. I think also the premise of many ways is not just that you have a, you know, genetic connection to your child, but that the zchiyot that parents get from their children's actions is because they raised them in the world, and they taught them certain midos tovos, them how to do mitzvos. And so, you know, to say that because you have a genetic connection, therefore this is going to be a case of Baram Zaka Abba, I'm not so sure about.
Is the father Mekayim Pru Ravu with a posthumously born child?
Big question, especially since he didn't do a Maisa for it. So there's a whole Chakira when it comes to mitzvah puravu. Is the mitzvah dependent on doing a maisa, doing an act, or do we just care about the end result? Rav Asher, though, thinks it's independent of that Chakira, because Rav Asher says the father passed away, without doing a Misa, he's no longer alive. You can't do mitzvah. It's from the grave. You can't do mitzvah when you're dead. So I'm not so sure. If you go,
so,
you know, both.
Let me go back to that. Let's say your father, the mitzvah puruvu is chal when the child is born. Is that correct?
In theory, the mitzvah puruvu is chal when a child is born. Although we also care about grandchildren as well.
Okay, great. So according to Rabbi Shawais, if a guy impregnated his wife, she's in her eighth month and he dies, and then the child is born, is the father not Mekayim Puruvu?
The father did a Maisa when he was alive, so...
I understand, but the Kiyum would be posthumously. Can you have a Kiyum mitzvah posthumously?
You can have a Kiyum seemingly posthumously.
Okay, right? Yes, you can. So I would ask the following question under Rabbi Shawais, that... The Beis Shmuel famously says in Ebenezer that a child born Bambatya would have a din of your child and you would be Mekayim Puruvu. So this is without a Maisa whatsoever, right?
And yet you're
Mekayim Puruvu. So why would this child who the Zera was taken from posthumously be worse than a child who was from an Isha who was this Abra Bambatya that the father's Mekayim Puruvu?
So first of all, we should note that the Beit Shmuel is not the only opinion on this, right? The Taz brings down the Shita as well, which says if you didn't do a Maisa, you can't be Mekayim the Mitzvah here.
Yeah.
And I think
But the Chalkas B'chaykek and the Beit Shmuel are two very big shoulders to lean on, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, listen, you can argue that you're Mekayim the Mitzvah per view here. You can make the argument, you can make it back. And the question is how meaningful is the notion of being Mekayim this mitzvah when you're no longer alive, right? In other words, when everything's being done afterwards. I think you can give other reasons beyond the technical fulfillment of Pura Verivia to say why this is meaningful. And I think you can argue in saying you are Mekayim the mitzvah, but nonetheless, we shouldn't do this. I'm not so sure the whole issue is toloy on whether you're Mekayim the mitzvah or Pura Verivia.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the case before where a woman... who was married, who did not have children, a soldier's wife, and imagine this is a current case, wants to have children with her husband posthumously, so there's a zecher for him. Now, here's a very interesting case. Since he died without children, she's mechuyeves b'chalitza, right?
Right.
So even though she would have children posthumously, she would still be mechuyev b'chalitza. Because that child born afterwards, the pashtus without pater from Yibam.
Well, that's the pashtus. It might be depends on if you think that there is a key of the period of Rivi here. In that respect, it might have some consequence. But you could say the two are not related to each other. Meaning, in Echanami, she could have to do chalitza, but then also bring his child to the world at some point later on.
Yeah. So she would be b'chuyev b'chalitza because she's an eishasach she'ein labanim to anybody who loves Yibamus, and then she would be an eishasach Shiesh Labanim afterwards, which leads us, by the way, to a riddle that if anybody is learning a yeshiva that learns Yevamos, here's a fabulous riddle. How, ask your Rosh Yeshiva, how do you have a guy who dies? How do you have a woman who has two or three children from her husband who died, and yet she's Mechuyev Yibam to the brother?
I love it. It's a great riddle.
And I guarantee you, I'll bet anybody on the program, $100, your Rosh Hashiva is not going to get this answer. And the answer is, she got pregnant posthumously from the Zera of the husband. So she could do it two or three times. Now you have an Isha with three kids, and she would be going, Zman HaGemara, she would be Eilul Yibam. So she would be an Eishes Ach with three Banim, and yet she would be Mechuyev B'Yibam. Interesting case, no?
Great case. It's a great case. But, you know, I know you're sort of partly, you know, talking a little bit of pull among this here, but I think even the very question that you're giving, right, that it sort of raises this larger issue. With all the pilpul that we can do back and forth in the chakiras and Mekayim the mitzvah, not Mekayim the mitzvah, I think everyone understands there's a much larger issue here at stake, which is what do we want to do for people in terms of after they die tragically young, what we don't want to do for the widows, and how do we see this whole technology, the powerful technology of IVF, and what we want to utilize that for. You know, some of the post-game initially on were very against IVF precisely because they were afraid that we're going to start playing games, so to speak, with how children are born and brought into this world. And we see IVF, all of its many, 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 many blessings that's brought to the world, also brings some of these questions as well. So, you know, I think that, your question, you know, it raises the issue of how much we're going to make this decision based on these types of chakirot.
Right. So let me go into the back to this question. They want to take the zera from a soldier who died, right? There are a number of halachic issues that have to be discussed here. One is, would it be called hana from the mace? You're not allowed to have any benefit from a mace. Now that you're taking zera from the mace, would that be called hana min a mace? Would that be a problem?
So seemingly the size here of the zera is too small to make it an issue of hana to met here.
Where do we find you mean a kazayas or a kebaya for hana?
Yeah, we're talking such a small amount here. It's not clear that that would be a violation. And of course, if you're making the assumption though that you're doing it lechvod ames, right, that you're doing this for that purpose, you might argue here that that's the type of hana that would be allowed anyway. But I think the amount that we're talking about is too small to be a violation.
I don't know that the iser hana, isuri hana, would not make a difference if it was l'chvodo or not. I think if it was b'zoyin hameis, you could say it's not b'zoyin, it's l'chvodo. But if it's hana min hameis, and why wouldn't there be a problem in a chatzi shir?
You can make such an argument, but I think that the size here is so small, and it's klodo, you pull the two together, that you're going to come with a head there here.
Let me give you a different possibility as well. The organs min hameis you're allowed to take, because even if it's a b'zayin hameis, it's still the mitzvah of l'samed al damriyach, the mitzvah of hatzalah would be docha the din of b'zayin hameis, but that's why they could take organs from a dead person. However, a cornea, for example, they want to take a cornea from a mace. A cornea is not hatzalas nefashis. So you're being nene from a mace, and you don't have the heter of hatzalas nefashis. How are you allowed to go about it? So when they started doing corneal transplants, believe it or not, this question came up in the early 1900s, which is astonishing because I didn't know they did it then. But the Paiskim then, in particular, the Rav of Yerushalayim, the Har Tzvi, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, He said a chiddush. He said hana min ames, it has to be derech hana. So you can't take the hair from hana from a mace, let's say, and use it to stuff a pillow. That would be derech hana. But taking a cornea from a mace for another mace, that is not called derech hana. Interesting chiddush, which would apply here as well. Taking the zera is certainly not the derech hana of a mace.
All right, that's definitely one of the studs.
I'll tell you. Another problem that you have, but I'll tell you an interesting story. My great grandfather sat on the bezdin of Yerushalayim. And they wanted to put Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank into Cheirim because he was a Rav Mitam HaMedina, right? He was the Rav Rashi of Yerushalayim, paid by the government. And they lived in Batei Verna. And my grandfather absolutely refused. And they asked him why. He says, because he's a neighbor of his in Batei Verna. And he saw how they sold his mattress so that he could buy neft, like oil, basically, to light the lamp so he would be able to learn at night. So he slept on a board. He sold his mattress to be able to, because he was such a masmith. He says, I cannot put such a person into a cheirim. Mm-hmm. Interesting story of a Malaga Gedayla. Mm-hmm. So let's go now. There's another issur of halana sameis. You know, you have to bury your mace the same day. And the question is, these medical procedures, all of them, they have to keep the mace around for another day or two or three. Why wouldn't there be a problem of halana sameis?
First of all, halana sameis can be overridden when something's done the chvodo, which is why sometimes we delay. And second of all, the amount of time it takes to do the procedure when it's set up is actually quite a short amount of time.
Okay.
It's not a very extensive procedure here.
Now, what about nibul hameis?
So the depends on how quickly they can do the procurement of the zera. Some of the ways that's done, particularly if it's done within 12 or 24 hours, is really hard to say it's nivul. You don't really have to do any form of incision. But even if you have to do an incision at a little bit later stage, the incision is so minuscule. It's very, very small. And once again, especially if it's done l'chvodo, I don't think I have a problem here with nivul amet.
Now, I was told by somebody who's involved, and I don't know, it could be secondhand, that if it's after 36 hours, then they actually have to remove one of the testicles of the mace and crush it, and it's quite gory, he said. Like, why wouldn't that be constituted nibul hameis?
Well, there's no doubt it would be better, much better, luckily for that reason, to do it in the earlier stage when it's possible. Unfortunately, some of the cases here that happened since October 7th, it took much longer to get the corpses to the hospital where anything could be done. So that's one of the reasons why certainly, and whether it's done for that technique or other techniques, certainly would mitigate some of these problems. But you have to ultimately say, and this is why I think that you really have to make this assumption that you're doing something lichvodo. There are times when we allow autopsies, for example, right? When we have a criminal case, you allow autopsy so we can bring someone to justice and make sure this person isn't killed, and the person kills him, you know, doesn't stay free. So, you know, you can make some form of argument here as well of why this wouldn't be nivolumab, but obviously we'd want to be done as soon as possible and avoid that form of strategy.
So let me share with you another possibility, that nivolumab, the Nei Dvi Yehuda seems to Neman imply that it's also L'Kvaydei Shalmeis, or Tevasei Shalmeis would be allowed. And he brings the Tshuvas HaRashba. He says they wanted to bring somebody, bury him in Eretz Yisrael, but they didn't want to bring the body, just the bones. So he said they could take the body and soak it in lye so that it quickly decays, so that they could bury the bones in a more expedited fashion.
Right, the Ramah passes that way as well, the lime
right.
seed. That's
right.
Seed.
So the Nei Dvi Yehuda seems to take from that. He said that Nibul HaMeis is only if it's not L'Kvaydei Shalmeis. If it's L'Kvaydei Shalmeis, it wouldn't be Nibul, and that could possibly work here as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think so as well. That's what I was saying. All these issues of autopsies where it comes up, but when it's really being done L'Kvodo, there's more room to be made on that.
Now, let me ask you a question. Going to organs. Let's say a guy dies and his organs are harvestable.
Mm-hmm.
He has two kidneys, and today they could keep extending the period so that they could take it out. I've heard one doctor say it's as long as 72 hours, they can still get you, you know, for harvest. And he didn't leave any letter allowing it to happen. He didn't give permission. And you're a hospital, and you have five patients or six patients critically ill. Two need kidneys, one needs a heart, one needs a liver. One needs a small intestine, one needs a large intestine, two need lungs, nine people. Could you do it halachically, shaloi b'rishos hameis?
So there is a sheet of Ratzon Arusi, who's on the Chashuva Dayanim here in Israel in Kiryat Ono, who thinks in general, once someone's deceased, we don't give it a choice, because they could save someone's life. You don't have bilis over your body. And it could save life, and it shouldn't be a matter of a choice at all. I don't think that that people take that approach. I think that we're nervous, probably on a governmental level, we want the government taking people's, you know, organs that way. But just in general, this idea that we have in general, that if a person hasn't left their own subwa, hasn't left their own will on what they'd want, a family member, nearest of kin, can make a substitute judgment on their behalf. And especially since you're talking about here the opportunity to give the nistar, the zchut of saving other people's lives. I mean, it's the greatest chesed shelamet, that you go up to Shemaim, you save people's lives. Nothing can be better than that. So I think there's a very good reason to say that others can make that decision on their behalf.
Is there anybody who halachically argues on this?
I think in general, if you assume the whole debate over organ donation is when we say someone's dead, when the time of death is. But in general, it's understood that everyone would agree that if we all agree that the person has died, it's a tremendous source for the person to save someone else's life. And even if they didn't see it as a source, who says you can give up the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh of and lo tamal dam recha?
So even if he's opposed to it, halachically you would still be allowed to?
You can make such an argument. I don't think the post can say it this way.
Why not? What's the other side of this argument?
I think that the reason why people haven't said it this way is only because they're nervous about, in practice, people being declared dead when they're not dead.
Okay.
But in theory, if you think that, let's say, brain death is a halachic criteria of death, it's really hard to understand why you should have a choice.
No, but even if the heart death is the let's talk about where there is heart death. I don't want to get involved in that machlokes. Cardiac death. And there are the physicians I've spoken to who said post-cardiac death with modern techniques, they can harvest organs 6 hours, 12 hours, 72 hours, depending on the organ. So I don't want to get involved in the cardio brain machlokes.
Right.
I'm saying once we agree that L'Kuli Alma, this is a dead person, and now there's a mitzvah. You as the doctor have a mitzvah of Hatzalos Nefashis of the other person. You would have a right to take those limbs, or those organs rather, out of this mace, regardless of his objection, to save a chai. And I asked a number of rabbanim this question, and none of them could give me an answer as to why it would be Asa. Except for, I asked Rabbi Aaron Sosha why it would be Asa, and he said, it wouldn't be Asa, but you would lose your medical license. Absolutely right about that. But they sort of agreed with it. I couldn't think of a reason to answer it.
Not only should I answer it, meaning it might be that you're mechuyav.
Yeah, you're mechuyav to do it. Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. Many poskim are really against this posthumous retrieval of the zera.
Because they're very against it. Because of what?
Because of the, I think more or less because they don't believe in this idea of bringing children into the world without a mother and a father.
Let me ask you a question. Let's see a guy, Rahman Otsvan, gets married, and they find out he's terminally ill. He has 6 months left to live. Would the Paiskim who say that they don't want the wife impregnated by her dead husband's child or sperm post-Misa, would they encourage him also not to have relations with his wife so as not to have a child because the child they're bringing up would be a Yasim?
It's a great question. I think the answer is no. No one would encourage someone not to do that.
Why not?
It's a good question. I think that this comes down to a distinction between a person doing something when they're alive and they have the ratzon, they have the ability to make those decisions.
Let's say the soldier wrote a letter. He would like his thing removed. Those types can still be opposed?
There definitely are those who are opposed. They just think the mitzvah can be done afterwards. But certainly it's always better to allow something if you know you have the consent, not just implicit consent, but the explicit request of the niftar that would want his heir to use in this way.
Because, and the reason to have it, if it's his consent, the value of the consent halachically is that?
It's seen as much more of his maisa or his will, that you feel like, okay, we're going to be mekayim, in the spirit of lekayim divrei emes, right? In the spirit of being mekayim, the person's last wishes.
Interesting. Okay. Rabbi Brody, it's been an honor to have you on with us. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye. Joining us from Israel is Orit Rosenblum. She's the founder of the New Family Organization. It was founded in 1998. She's a lawyer and a philosopher. She's written many books, including The Ethics of the New Family. Welcome, Orit.
Welcome.
So tell us about how you got to be involved in such a fascinating topic.
As a lawyer at the early 80s already, I used to deal with family law. Everybody knows that family law is divorce, separating. But I realized that here in Israel, people want to make the process easier. And that's how I get related to people who want to make a contract. And as a lawyer, as a family lawyer, the first case that I met was a young man that decided to get married and to make a prenup contract. But he asked me to talk with me a few times earlier before we set the meeting, while he told me that while he joined the army, he got sick and lost his ability to be a father. He became sterilized because of illness whatsoever, but he is pretty alive. And he asked me to help him to explain his girlfriend that he is not going to have children with her. It was quite a shock because, really, I'm not dealing with such issues. What do you want from me? I asked him. And he said, please help me to deliver, to explain to her that she must know. He never told her. And they are going to get married, okay? It's a challenge. I decided to speak with her, to explain her to the situation. I believe those days that maybe there is solutions, you know. Yes, we are talking about new technologies. They can adapt whatsoever, and they can do. And she agreed to continue. It was really a happy day for him. But the same day, I got to realize that there is an issue here. If this young man could freeze his sperm in advance while he is serving the army, that was the case. Maybe we can make a life insurance for everybody. As long as you are a young person and you want to be sure that you will have children, why not to check the possibilities and to use the technology to freeze it? I started a research in sperm banks in Israel. We have 15. I met all the leaders of the sperm banks, asked them questions, investigate. Is it really that we are sometimes in our life can lost our ability to have children? And what can we do for it? They said, yes, indeed, especially if you are in the army, you are risking your life in extreme sports, everything. Okay. This was the beginning of a new era that I decided to start the project of the biological will, which says that we as healthy people are able to freeze our gametes. We can use it later on in our life in case something will happen to us. And the same moment I started the project, I got really a rain of phones from parents who lost their children while they served the Israeli army. And they said, we donate every organ that we could do from our late relatives. How come nobody told us that there is a possibility to freeze the gamut? And I forgot to mention that the posthumous the gametes can be even 72 hours after death. So if you didn't use the opportunity to freeze it in advance or to write a document that this is your will, your family, if you let them know, they can do it 72 hours after you passed away. So this is a great change. And this would happen at the October 7th, that the project, the idea, became alive again. This is double meaning, became alive. Because this is the way that we can continue the legacy of a late person, especially after what we got through. Lots of families, more than 100 families, ask to use the gametes, the sperms of their late sons, soldiers, even civil people, because you know we had the party over there, and this is a start that of new life that I'm pretty much involved. During the time, I create a new project on the name of Follow Me, which
Acharei? What is it, Acharei?
Yes, yeah. Acharei. I gathered 24 lawyers, volunteers, all of them, that helped the families who are asking us help, legal help, and a project of, we built an internet form calling the everybody who wants to freeze or a continuation, let's call it, it's a ktav ratzon, a goodwill, like a last will, that you are asking in case something will happen to you, please continue my legacy. This is the form, and it's in the internet, and we spread it all over, and we have lots of people who already signed on it.
Did you encounter at any point, because of this, any opposition? You know, people for different reasons were opposed to posthumous life, to removal after death of the sperm. Was it easy going?
Not. Of course, this, you know, it's a new project. A lot of fear. Question of halakha was not asked, because it's really the same dialect of the halacha of continuation.
So was there any opposition? That's my question.
Opposition, of course. The opposition, there is. First of all, those people who think that this is cause immorality. We're sending the soldier to the army. They don't. They're too young to think about this. You know, questions of death, of continuation. It's a heavy burden for them. To this argument,
So what's the argument? I don't understand.
The argument is that the project caused immorality.
What's the immorality? That what?
Yeah.
What is the immorality?
Immorality, because we are open their mind to the possibility that they are going to die.
So you're scaring the soldiers.
Yeah.
Well, wouldn't you think that soldiers who are going into battle are very aware of the possibility that they would die? I mean, they're not going to play football. They're going.
This is immoral or unethic not to tell them this is a possibility. So if you are not telling them or not exposing them to this, either you using them because
right.
you think they are too
right.
too young. That's it. So this is the answer to this opposition.
And I want to continue that. It says, Katub Gemara, that in the times of Shlomo, his soldiers would write, of David, they would write a get, they would write a divorce a petition to their wife in advance, why, in case they disappeared or they became, so she shouldn't be an aguna in the battle, etc. So you see, already biblically, or rather Talmudically, this is discussed, this option, and it's considered moral.
Yeah.
What other opposition did you encounter?
That we are in advance creating an orphan.
That is
what
something I've heard
child?
From many rabbis. I've heard this question. How did you answer? I'm curious. How did you answer it?
Yeah, it's not so complicated to answer. First of all, nobody asked to be born. It's better to be born to our two healthy young people, nice, happy, wealthy, rich, smart. So, but it doesn't happen. Because nobody asks to be born. The minute you are born to a good family that wants you, that wants to to create your life, to take care of you, to love you. So this is really the best creation that can be. That it's a win-win situation. Everybody wants the child in a place that there is a sperm bank in Israel. All over the liberal country, we have a sperm bank that women take donation of sperm and raise a child, know nothing about his legacy, about his DNA, his ancestors, nothing. He came from the bank. In this case, he knows his legacy. He win a family, a grandparents, cousins, uncles and and a whole family. Of course, it's better not, but this is the best that can possible. So the decision to raise an orphan is a decision of the parents. It's the child won't be raised by the grandparents. He will be raised by a mother, a woman, that instead of taking a sperm bank of anonymous donor, she is taking this donation, not as a donation, she is going to be the mother, the real mother who will raise the child. And he will have a whole family. So I think this is a great solution for everybody, for the child, for the woman, for the family. Everybody is happy.
Right. And now, did you have to litigate any of these issues?
Of course, because...
So give us an example of a litigation. Tell us about a litigation that you had in this matter.
I had a lot. A family that I used to represent 10 years ago, and it took like 8 years after they lost their son. We had a heavy legal process that I represent, litigate them in court, because we need the exception of the system, that the system will allow using the sperm out of sperm bank. In Israel, the sperm bank, it's not a private bank. The state holds the sperm banks, and the attorney general gives the right to use it. So we have to appeal to court, asking the permission to use the sperm, allowing to have the new mother involved in this process. The family that I represented found a mother. They came from northern Israel, and she's from south of Israel. And she gave birth to a great daughter, a girl that she raised her very well. Unfortunately, they were involved in October 7th in the South.
Oh, my goodness.
And they are pretty much involved. It was really horror for the family, but they saved. They lost the girl's uncle. He got killed, but the mother and the child saved. And this is like, you know, a life circle that we are getting through here in Israel. Unbelievable. This daughter is built out of gold. We had to really keep her in life. But this
now,
is
when you so when you say you had to litigate it, who was opposed to doing this?
The attorney general.
Why? On what grounds?
First of all, he's able.
Sure.
Always he opposed. Always. Because and because it's new.
Did you share with us another litigation, something where the person on the other side had a real argument?
The real argument is always the same argument, because I'm arguing that they are deserve of continuation. The Attorney General says it's not obvious. You have to prove that this was the real will of the late person, that he wanted it. And I'm telling, it doesn't matter. Because I'm proving always, because otherwise they won't let me. To prove it, sometimes I have, documents that shows that this was his plan. Sometimes he frees in advance. Sometimes he left documents that he wrote it perfectly. And usually we don't have great documents.
No, like you said, these young people aren't planning for this. Yeah,
They are more exposed nowadays. So we have a lot of young people that already prove it.
Oh, interesting.
But even though I think there is no better way to respect a late person than to continue his legacy.
I'm curious, Irit, have you ever done a survey of, 500 young people and said, if indeed you were to die, would you want your legacy to continue? Has a survey like that ever been done?
I did it years ago, few surveys, and it's improved all the time. At the beginning, it was really, it's like a freak show. Who is doing it? What's going on here? Because people are afraid from the technology, from the change, from a new, something very, very new. But during the time, after awareness, more and more cases get famous, that people are really interested and said, why not? Because I'm telling you, as a witness, that those families became so happy. I have the ability, and we have as a society, to bring them back to life, to make meaning to their existence. They want to wake every morning because they have a purpose. So not to do it, this is a crime.
So, Irit, have you ever had a family that regretted bringing the child back to life?
Never, ever. I don't know such a thing.
Now, have you spoken to the rabbis in Israel about this?
All the time. Nowadays, we have we started the legal process to change the law. So the rabbis are pretty much involved. To change the law, to create a law. It's not to change the law, to create a law, because there is no law. We are acting in court only. So it's that jurisdiction. We have no written law about it. Most of the rabbis support, because of the fact that we are, Purvu, this is the legacy of the Judaism. This is our tradition. And why not?
And those who are opposed, what are the reasons that they give?
It's really sometimes the resolution of the opposition came out of the process after death. What procedure after death? I mean, the procedure of
removing the sperm.
Removing the sperm, and they have some questions about it. I'm not so much involved. I think we can do it in advance. The minute the person gives the permission. So it will be easier. That's why the project of Acharei, that they're leaving, a document that proves their willingness, that they know the process and they will accept it in case to make their family happy and to make continuation of themselves.
But you don't know an exact reason why the rabbis are against it? I mean, for the most part, they're very legal and they're thoughtful. Like, they must have certain particular arguments.
The argument, that's what I told you. This is the basic argument that I heard from the rabbis.
Is that there is no...
It must be very clean procedures after death.
In other words, they're nibul hamet. They're worried about disrespect for the meh.
Yes. Yes. This is what's really keeping them involved, because all the other arguments, they're really for it.
Interesting. Wow. This is fascinating.
Yeah.
Any other story you want to share with us that you think is worthwhile? I heard a story where a fellow died or was killed, and his wife remarried, and she was opposed to her ex-husband, her widowed, her dead husband having children without her.
Yes.
And there was a big court case in Israel. Were you involved with that at all?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, it's a very sad story about a couple that were married only 3 months, and he got killed in an accident while he was in the army. And the widow decided not to allow using the sperm. The question was, who is the owner? Is the family, the parents that lost their child that they raised 35 years, and in a minute, a woman that got his married to him, she's the owner? So we are treating or getting to this question as a property issue. Who is the owner? So she opposed, you know, and it came to the Supreme Court in Israel.
On what grounds was she opposed?
Nobody knows. But till the end of the procedure, after all those appeal and whatever happened in court, she got married, she got two children, and she raised a new family. She forgot about the story, but they left the parents broken and very, very sad. And they are, but Israeli Supreme Court decided that she has the key. And
that's terrible.
It's terrible.
Terrible rule, yeah. And?
Till nowadays, I heard already, this is a rumor, that she might regret a little bit. But you know, life is over. They are getting older. They are very, very tired. And really, they lost a lot of money. I don't know what will happen with this story. But I see this jurisdiction as a big mistake. Big mistake.
Why did she care that two grand, and it was an only son too, I was told, right? What did they care that somebody should be?
She never gave a reason. The jurisdiction was based on the right when people are getting married. They have a secret like decision that this is an axioma that they want continuation, and they are owners of each other. So the minute they married, she is the owner.
And that's how the Supreme Court ruled.
Yeah, it means that those people who were not married, single person who get died, they still left the window to the parents to appeal. But in case somebody is married, first one who will decide it will be the partner, the spouse, and if not, nobody. That's what happened in this decision.
Terrible decision, my opinion.
Terrible.
Yeah. Well, Ruth, thank you very much. This is very enlightening. And Chazak Ve'amatz, I think the work you do is like the closest thing on this world that we have. What does it say by Eliyahu when he brought the child back to life?
Yeah.
Right, by the Shunamis, it says he put his face on the child's face and his hands on it, and he blew life back into the child. This is the closest that we're going to see to it, right? You are the one who does that.
Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, thank you. And Rak Nishma B'surot
Tovot.
Take care. Bye-bye. Joining us from Eretz Yisrael is Rav Gideon Weitzman. He's the head of PUA. It's an organization that deals with the issues of fertility in halacha. Among the rabbanim who they share leitzu with is used to be Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Yashiv, and Lahavdil ben Achayim have today Rav David Cohen, Rav Belsky, well, also now the nifter of Rav First, Rav Asher Weiss from the Chassidim, I have from Chabad, Rav Farkash. Welcome, Rav Gideon.
Thank you very, very much, Rav Lichtenstein. Always a pleasure to speak to you.
So what do you say to the following question? And this happens. Rahman al-Slan, you have somebody. Their son was killed in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still 24 hours after the death. And they have the ability to take zera from the mace and freeze it. And at some later date to find a surrogate who's willing to be, you know, take an egg and be impregnated or impregnated with an egg and then planted in the surrogate and be making zera shel kayama, that this family now has a memory of the boy who was killed, who was nirzach, right? And it's happened, I understand, many times in Eretz Yisrael, and it's something that's ongoing during the war, more prominently with Rachman Olitzlan, it's a Ben Yachid, the one who was killed.
Mm-hmm.
Have these shilas come to you, and how have you dealt with them?
So it's a very tragic question, unfortunately. And we have dealt with this for very, very intensively in the past few months. And before that, obviously, there's sort of questions that came before, not only in times of war, but times of people who were sick, who underwent treatment and unfortunately passed away, and the parents want to either have sperm that they've frozen prior to getting sick or they were getting sick, or to take posthumously, take after they were killed. Currently, because of the war, this has become a very prominent shaila. We've been asked this several times, and in fact, one of the rabbanim in Machon Puah here in Eretz Yisrael, Lior Segev, has spent a tremendous amount of time not only investigating this question, but also sitting in the Knesset on the Va'adot, on the various boards that deal with this question. And we have been supported by various Chavrei Knesset, religious Chavrei Knesset, who have supported our position. And he spent a lot of time investigating in this question. And we've met also with parents, with spouses, with family members of soldiers who were killed. It's obviously a very, very difficult question because you are faced with, on the one hand, the tragedy, as you said, losing a ben yachid, even not a ben, every child in the eyes of the Kadosh Baruch Hu, in the eyes of the parents, is a ben yachid. And so it's obviously very, very tragic. Meidach, there's also a finality of the fact that when someone dies, they die. And even though we have the din of Yibum, that's a din d'oraita, that's a special, special situation that the Torah speaks about. It's obviously not taking that person's zera, but it's more of a metaphysical, a spiritual understanding of the continuation of that person's life. But the finality is very important. And sometimes the idea of having closure and understanding that with all of the tragedy, with all of our heartache, with all of our filot, that shouldn't happen, the person did die, and the Kodesh Baruch Hu, that was his decision, there's an important understanding a message to say that there's a finality. That's Gezerat Hashem, Ratzon Hashem, and I give you an example that some years ago I said we used to deal with this before, not in the war situation. We had a young man who underwent cancer treatment, and he was in his teens, and he froze sperm, and he died. And the couple then wanted to use the sperm exactly as he just described. They used it for a woman who would then a surrogate. I mean, the child was not married, obviously, it was a young man. And they wanted to use it, and they came to ask us, and we asked Rav Mordechai Eliyahu Zatzal, and Rav Eliyahu said they should bury the Zera together with the young man. So, of course, the Zera is not mechuyav in Kvura, according to Mosteot. It's not an ever, it's not a limb of a person. And the reason he said that is not because halachically there's a chovah to bury the sperm, but as we said, there's an idea that the parent should understand the finality of Gezerat Hashem, that the person died, and we have to realize that that's what Hashem wanted.
So he was opposed. So Rabbi Eliyahu was opposed to it.
Rabbi Eliyahu was very opposed to it.
Based on what?
Again, well, I think there's a different question. Several questions. And first of all, you said it, and you played it very, very carefully within 24 hours. Let's just midayek on the exact medical reality. Okay.
So wait, but before the medical reality, why was he opposed to it?
I want to explain, because I think there's a number of ideas here.
Okay.
The first is the question of nivul amit, right? Nivul amit of doing an operation on the child. That's obviously not when he had zera. But the idea is that...
In the case of Rabbi Eliyahu, you didn't have that issue.
That wasn't a question of it. That's the question of nivul amit that's relevant here, and we should discuss that in the next few minutes that we're speaking, because that's really the issue that we've been discussing in the Knesset and discussing with the family. The question of having zera already that existed, the question is, is there a heker to create a child who's basically an orphan? I sat with an almana recently, an almana, her husband was killed in Gaza. She has three children from him, and they... When he was ill, he was injured, and he was in hospital for 2 weeks, and she considered freezing sperm. She obviously believed that he was going to get better, and he died. And she said to me that she's raising in her house three yatomim, three orphans, and she says that to create an orphan is really not it's not so pashut that we'd have to do that, because the child isn't here. It's not like you have parents who tragically were killed. We've had that also. But it's to create mirosh, an orphan. An orphan is umlal. It's to create someone who will be sad, who will be disadvantaged. Is there something that one of the reasons that we have an issur of nivul amit, according to the Ritva, is because it's v'hafter recha kamocha. The chovah is that we have to make sure what is the best way to create people who what we would like to have. What would be the best situation for that person, and to create.
So I have a question for you.
Of course, the simcha.
Yeah. If you would ask the child who was born, this Yassim, right, and who will be very beloved by his mother or grandparents, sure, whatever the case may be, right, he's the only Zera Shel Kayama, and you would ask him, when he's a Bardas, would you prefer never to have been born? What would he respond? I can't imagine anybody's going to say, unless he's really tragic, I would prefer not to be born. So when you say...
One of the Rabbanim in Machon Pua, his father died before he was born. His mother was pregnant, his father died of an illness. And he said, I experienced it. I experienced being born without a father. It is a tragic experience. I was disadvantaged among all my friends. To say I'm better to be born, not to be born, is a very, very good question, which, of course, no one can answer. But he said it's definitely clear that I am disadvantaged.
Without a doubt. And then if you asked him, would you prefer... If you ask this guy, would you prefer not to have been born? I just can't imagine anybody would say, yeah, I would prefer that to be.
I don't think we have an answer. I think we can. We know. There's no.
But I don't know anybody, unless it was a manic depressive or suicidal, would say I'd prefer not to have been born. I think that sort of answers the question.
But David, let's understand. If that's the case, we can take any child in any circumstance and we can say, would they prefer to be born? A mumzer, would they prefer to be born? Maybe you can say the same. But yet, halakhically, of course we wouldn't create a mumzer. It's a thought to create a mumzer, to create a child who would...
But that's the difference. I think there's a difference. I think to create somebody who's halakhically very problematic, we say, look, we follow the halakha. But here there is no halakha. So now it's just a question of common sense or feeling. So we say, would the guy prefer not to be born? He said, of course I prefer to be born. So one's a halachic issue, one's not a halachic issue.
That's a good question, but I'm saying that poskim that we spoke to were very adamant in such a case. You have to make also a distinction, I think. Bringing children to the world is not only my personal choice. It's also a mitzvah. There's a mitzvah, and we mekayim the mitzvah, and we know that people go to great lengths. We're in Pu'ah and dealing with fertility, and I'm sure you know we've been on the program before, and you've discussed these issues before. People go to great lengths to mekayim the mitzvah, and also to have an existential need to have children. But that's for them, for themselves. It's not so clear that the use of limbs, or the use of a body, or the use of, in this case, sperm. In the desire of the person who died, without even knowing what their desire was, it's not so clear that that's something that we are permitted to do.
I have a klal in halacha.
Yeah.
Right, and it's a taz v'chulu. If it's not usur, it's permitted. So make the point why it should not be permitted.
If it's the Haftarah Recha Kamocha, if the Ritva says the reason of Nivula is that once a person dies, we don't...
Wouldn't anybody like to have somebody to say Kaddish for him? Who in the world doesn't want to have a legacy, a
Sheiris? We're now talking not halacha. We're talking about second-guessing what people want. And that's a very good question, but it's a very theoretical question. And we could say the exact opposite. Would someone want... Someone running around with their Zera that they never were met. They never met that woman. She was not their wife. It was not their spouse. They had no connection with them.
That's a good question.
My parents will decide. My parents would decide what will happen with my genetic material. It's the opposite. Maybe I would say
if you put it to 10 people, you could have Zera Shel Kayam and somebody to have Kaddish for you. Like they say in Yiddish, a Kaddish Zera, a Kaddish Shel.
Yeah.
And it would be from an anonymous donor, right?
Is in the process of doing a study exactly to test that.
Yeah,
to do a study to say...
My gut would be is everybody would want to have a Kaddish Zaga.
I don't know.
Okay, let's continue.
But again, that's we're talking about a theoretical guessing game of what people want. And that's, I don't think halakha is in, that's not the realm of halakha. That's the realm of guessing what people want. In the same way that Gemara didn't sit around and say, let's ask people what they wanted. That was a decision based on a deeper understanding of the human reality. But it wasn't a poll. They didn't poll people. They didn't poll 10 people and say, tell them they like that. I don't know if Beit Hillel thought differently than Beit Shammai. It was a halachic reason. But I don't think that's really guessing what people want. It's an interesting academic exercise, but I don't think that's where the halakha is at the moment.
I can't hear how halachic it is. So if it's an isser of nibul hameis, so the answer would be, I mean, there's two isser of haris, two shals, nibul hameis, and an is also bahana.
Right.
Right. So nibul hameis, my feeling would be, is if it's for taivas hameis, there wouldn't be an isser of nibul hameis. And whether you have a...
And where do you have?
And where do you have a raya to that? You have a raya from the Gemara in Yevamos. You have a raya from the guy who died, and they didn't know who got to be Yershim. Could they unbury him so that they could figure out who was Yershim? And the Gemara says you can, and the Shulchan Aruch says you can, because that's called the type of Sameis.
That's right. So that's a Tovat Amet. The Tovat Amet here, again, we have to guess.
And you see, the Yershim is considered the type of Sameis. So if we would establish that most people would want to have Zerah Shel Kayama, then it certainly would be considered the type of Sameis. I had a very interesting, I had a story years ago, listen to that interesting story. It is Nebuch, sadly, many girls who become older, they go into their 30s, 40s, and they can't find a shidduch.
Right.
And they want to have a child.
Right.
Could they take zera from somebody and implant it in an egg and create a child? Right. And they would carry the child themselves.
Right.
Otherwise, they would die alone in a nursing home.
Right.
Well, this way they could give all their love and affection and create a family. And to me, it was like a mamash dava pashit that you're allowed to, right? And I had on a number of rabbanim, including Rabbi David Cohn and Rabbi Herschel Shechta and from Bnei Brak, Mendel Shafran. And they said, halachically, it wouldn't be a problem, but you're creating an orphan.
Exactly. That's exactly the point.
And I asked him the following shaila. I said, what would be the halacha if you had a guy who gets married, and a few months after he's married, they find out he has a terminal illness, he has a year left to live. Would you tell him to restrain having intimacy with his wife because he's going to create an orphan, she's going to get pregnant and create an orphan or not? And all three of them said, absolutely not, he should have a child.
I would agree. Even without hearing what they said, I would have said that's the chapter.
So I said, I don't understand. In one minute you're saying you're making an orphan, it's a tragedy. The next minute you're saying, let's create an orphan without a doubt. What's the difference?
It's clear that the mitzvah, I mean, the Shulchan Aruch, you know, it's clear that as a mitzvah, if all the cholet, someone who doesn't have the mitzvah puruvu, that person's mekayim the mitzvah. It's questionable, even posthumously. We had a case in which we was it possible a posthumous birth or posthumous mekayim the mitzvah? Rav Neventhal told me it's mekayim the mitzvah even after he died, because the fact that there was already the puruvu, the kiyum the mitzvah. Machlokas, as we know, maybe the Kima Mitzvah is in the Ma'asebiyah, is Mekayma Mitzvah. So Mekayma Mitzvah is a very, very different situation. And taking, I think, most poskim are of the question whether there's a Kima Mitzvah to doing insemination with donor sperm. That's a very good question whether it's Kima Mitzvah. It's Kima Mitzvah, it's a very, very different thing.
So you're saying because you're a mitzvah, you're allowed to create an orphan.
I think it is different. I think that you understand that there's a different scenario between having a father figure who died.
But he's a yasim. You just told me about the fellow who grew up a yasim and was terribly disadvantaged his whole life.
No one would want that situation.
Good. So here you're creating a yasim.
You have a very good question, and I think that still the mitzvah does a person who's not a nevela, he's not a traitor, because we know he can still live for a year. But the question is he still mekayim? Is he still mechuyav the mitzvah?
He could be a traitor. He could very well be a traitor. He lived less than a year. So if he was going to live less than a year, would you tell him to stop having beer?
They offered a shidduch to a woman. The shidduch was Issa Zalman Meltzer. He was very, very sick. And they told her when they got engaged, he's gonna die. He's sick. And she said it's worth being married to Tommy Hochem even for a few months. And he got married and he lived till his 90s in a way that no doctor can understand. No doctor can understand how Issa Zalman survived.
So I'm asking you, if it's Baruch Hachama, this guy's got a few months to live. Would he still have relations with his wife?
I understand that the question, but
I don't hear an answer to the question. Okay.
It's very clear that those are two different situations. I understand. So you have a very good, because we analogize. Let's take another example, okay? Would there be, Shlomo Zalman asked this question, would there be a mitzvah of Yibum by doing insemination? You've become the mitzvah of Yibum by insemination. Rosh Hashanah says no. The mitzvah of Yibum is having relations. There's no inyan of doing Yibum, i.e. the idea that to do an insemination posthumously somehow creates that kiyum in Minchat Shlomo Tanina Kuf Chaf Dalet. He says, Gamze Pashut.
Let's go back to what's going on.
Right. I just want to say something about collecting sperm, just to understand how it works, because I think that there's a bit of a misconception of what happens. The first few hours, mamash few hours, is you're able to extract the sperm through a needle, you know, through an extraction, or sometimes even use electroejaculation to cause the person to ejaculate. But that's really, really only in the first few hours. That's only really a case of someone who dies in hospital. But the case that you raised at the beginning, which is bringing soldiers in from the field who were killed in the field, by the time they get on to retrieve the sperm, it's talking about doing an actual operation to remove, if not the entire testicle, half the testicle. That's clearly a question of nivulamate. So to remove a needle, Rav Moshe has a tshuva, but to remove a needle, that's not maybe considered to be nivulamate, because that's what someone would do that during their lifetime. But most people during their lifetime would not cut off half of the testicle or the whole testicle in order to have children. I think you have to understand that this is a situation which is clearly nivulamate. And then we get back to your question of, is that ratzon of the niftar? Because the person wanted, would not, that's Rav Moshe's tshuva, is that a person's willing to undergo what they died, what they would have undergo during their lifetime. But they wouldn't want to go after they died, what they wouldn't want to go under their lifetime. And therefore, it's clearly nivulamate against the desire of the person. We don't look at the result, and the fact that the actual operation itself is clearly a question of nivulamate, which according to many poskim is still deraita, we know, saying according to the Ritva is the question of Haftel Arecha Samocha. So there's clearly a difficult question of Nivulamit, which will exist in every single time we do operation. Again, in the idea that a person would not want to have that done, that's not something that would be normative to done during a lifetime, definitely not to have children. We don't have such a destructive operation during lifetime the person would do. It also would cause terrible ramifications for the person to have such a thing.
Why don't you say on that Esed HaLoisa thing?
So that we don't have in any case in Nivulamit. That's the question of the Gemara in Chulin, right? The question of Gemara in Chulin was a person who said, you know, why don't we do a operation to see whether the person the person was already not able to live. They were considered to be a trefa, and therefore we can do, you know, we'll do an operation to make, if they were trefa, the person that killed them is not chayav mita. We don't do that. Why don't we say they are selot tasei lo tasei? So that's why we said, that's why many of the rishonim have put in soul, and if one made is the writer, and we don't do it even if there's an estate included. Nivulamit, there's three reasons why it's a sore. Either it's baltalin, is that we're supposed to bury that person, either because it's a chovar kvura, not a baltalin, it's chovar kvura, or because it's v'hastel erecha kamocha. Segev, this wrote an article about this for Truman. So the editor of Truman said, well, if you bury the testicle later on, or you remove, extract the sperm, then there's not a question of burial. There's still a question of Avtalacha Kamocha. Avtalacha Kamocha, that's what Moshe says. It's only a case in which this is something I would be willing to do during my lifetime. People do not undergo an operation. Even if you take somebody, and I deal with this daily, you take someone who doesn't have any children, who we say the only way you can have children is to remove a testicle. Let's go back to your 10 people, we'll poll them. I think a large percentage of them will say, Adkan. No, that I'm not willing to do. I'm not willing to remove a testicle.
Why does it have to be during his lifetime? Why not posthumously? The person posthumously would certainly... What's his svara? Why?
That's the end of after Echa Kamocha.
Why can't after Echa Kamocha be? What would I want done to me now? Now that I'm dead, I wouldn't mind if it was taken from me.
I don't know. That's Chad of the Pasuk. That's not what it means. I don't know anybody explains that. And the other thing is that you're assuming, we're assuming that there was some sort of assumption made that the person wants to have children. I don't know if that assumption even exists. You know, it's hard to make. If a person said, I froze sperm before I went into battle, which we have, that's not so uncommon, and I wrote that I want to use that, if I die, I want to use that to have a child with Plonit or without Plonit, whoever you choose, that's a very different situation than the parents, mostly what it is, are deciding we want to have a child. The person never gave any indication, and some of the people we spoke to wanted to say, Uvda is the person didn't get married and didn't even have any, wasn't engaged, didn't have any person that they had any tension to raising a family. Who said that they wanted to raise? If they would have wanted to raise a family, they would have done it. And therefore, It's also clear to say that they would want to have children in class, especially if we would then explain to that person that having children even posthumously would mean to have this operation. Because I might say, I've come. I want to have children, but not under those circumstances. And I never gave any decision. I never left any indication that that was my desire. So I can argue, I agree. And when we have the discussion now in Pua when we were discussing this, and I raised the point that I think we can say that people do want to have children, but it's not so pashut to make that decision. Well,
would you go by Sarayev?
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't make that. But again, we're doing a study to see what people want. I think that people say, we're on children. Yeah. I think you say to the parents, let's go. This is to understand. The parents are making a decision. Right? The person's not here to make decisions. So we're making decisions for them. The parents will say, sure, my child would want to have a child, and we want to have grandchildren, of course. But and Sheila, I would want to have. Yeah, most of the parents are not in the room when that operation is being done. But if they were, Libby Omer, then most of the people would be horrified that that's what they were doing to their child,
and
they would posthumously. It's horrible. It's horrible. Why don't we have Nituach after the mate? It's horrible. It's Nivula mate. Posthumously, yeah, we want to look. I say, what do I care? What do I care where I'm buried? What do I care if I happen to be? No, because I think people looking at it would say that's clearly, if we believe in some metaphysical existence of the soul, I'm saying even for illness people understand that, I don't want that to happen to my...
Tell us some of the issues that you have. So these are soldiers that, is this actually happening in real time?
It is happening in real time. There have been about, I think, 60 cases since the beginning of the war of sperm that was culled. None of them have ended up in pregnancies. We're talking about sperm that's being frozen and being used for later on. And in fact,
were most of these single children, are you ben yachids or no?
They weren't necessarily ben yachids. No, not necessarily. No. I don't. That's a really good question. I don't even know if we have the data for that. I'm sure that that must be.
So how have the Rabbanim Paskin? Let's hear on the ground. How were the Rabbanim Paskin?
I think that all of the Rabbanim that we spoke to were very concerned with the question of who said Nivula Meit. Remember, you said Nivula Meit is not only Vavtalecha Kamocha. Nivula Meit is also the Chovah to bury the person. It's Bal Talin. We're clearly pushing off the burial.
Hello.
That's not going to be buried. So,
but I'll tell you something. It's a Baltalin.
It's not being buried. It's not being buried.
Yeah. Let's say a guy dies.
Yeah.
Right, and he's in China, and he's in someplace, and they want to bring him to Eretz Yisrael. It's going to take 3 days. Yeah. Is there an issue of Baltalin?
Then we have a question if it's Lechvodo.
Right.
We have a case, right?
Exactly. If his family, is far away, they want to come to Levi. So you see, the Isser Bal Tullin you don't have if it's for his benefit. So I would say having his parent or his uncle Shmuel is considered for his benefit, but him having a child saying Kaddish for him and perpetuating his legacy, that is not Lefi Kvodo.
It's not maybe the reality, and this is the reality, just between you and me and all your listeners, that if the person was asking the question, that would be one thing. It's not the person. It's often not even their spouse. It's their parent. Yeah, but a woman said to me, Almanat Sal said to me, it's egotistical to bring a child like that into the world. I said, I can never say that. I said, only you can say that because you're in that situation. She said, yeah, it's egotistical.
I would agree and I would disagree. Honestly, yeah. I would say if the guy had already a child or children, it's certainly egotistical. But if the guy did not have Zera Shel Kayama, right, then it's not egotistical because everybody wants to have a
kid. Please explain to me the distinction.
Yeah, if you have two children, you're Makayim Puruvu. Right.
Right.
So now you want more. Okay, I want more. Everybody wants more. Everything. So a normal person says, "Chabginug, Baruch Hashem, I have." That's egotistical. But I already ate. I don't have to be stuffed myself. So now a guy who says, "Somebody should say Kaddish for me. I should have a kiyum. One of my grandchildren should go be mekabel pnei Mashiach. I want something. I don't want to be." Nobody wants to be an Eitz Yavish. Right, so in that case, it's not egotistical. I think it's relevant. I think it's a relative question.
Sam told me banim banot. Exactly, the pasuk there says the opposite. I'm a lomishen. Yeah, okay, I'll go with you. Okay, but that's not a mitzvah. It's not a kingdom of mitzvah. You have a huge chiddush of David. Your huge chiddush is that you can mekayim this mitzvah posthumously by doing insemination to someone you never met. That's a big chiddush.
Well, let's go through both halves of the chiddush. The second half of the chiddush, somebody you never met, right? So the Gemara says that Ben Sira, right, was Mekayim Puruvu, and it was a Shachas
Achav. The Gemara does not say Ben Sira is Mekayim Puruvu. It's not true.
I think the Beis Shmuel says that.
Smag says.
And the Beis Shmuel brings it in, right? I haven't seen this in a decade.
The Gemara never says that.
I'm saying, but the Smag on that case, the Beis Shmuel says he's Mekayim Puruvu. Okay, look, you have the great. Listen, the great Beis Shmuel says you're Mekayim Puruvu, right?
The guy is a sperm donor. I think that it's a stretch to say he's Mekayim Puruvu. It's a stretch to say that.
I think it's a stretch to say he's not. I think it's a stretch to say that he's not Mekayim Puruvu.
It's a stretch to say that. If I could give Mekayim Puruvu, it's kind of. Don't we think that Puruvu is something much more intimate and much more real than just leaving Zera in a lab and then going away? That seems to be. We know that the word that the holder, when the Gemara uses Puruvu, he uses it in many, many different cases. So we know that the Eved is Mechuyev and Puruvu. We know that Yoshua was Nenash, that he was Maneh et Am Yisrael. Laila Echad mi Puruvu. What does it mean? Everybody that night was going to get pregnant? Puruvu also means having relations. Puruvu also means living a married life. That's what the word Puruvu, the concept is not only a genetic reality. And so most cases and in normality would be that we have a couple who are married and they Mekayim the Mitzvah. Sometimes they need artificial insemination. Sometimes they need to have help. But what's Rasson Hashem? Let's go back to what does the Kodesh Baruch Hu want? Does the Kodesh Baruch Hu want us to ejaculate into bathtubs and get people pregnant? And the answer clearly would be no. So to say this is a kiyum of a mitzvah posthumously, someone ejaculating in a bathtub dies and then is Mekayim the Mitzvah, it's a stretch to say that that's really what the mitzvah meant. And that the parents can decide that. The person living in the jacket and the bathtub, the parents are going to come and say, we'll make sure that our child is Mekayim the Mitzvah. And the reality is, and we've spoken to these parents, is that they're not really concerned with the mitzvah. They're concerned with, they want to have a memory. And that's what I go back to how we started. They think that there's a certain psychological importance of saying, with all the tragedy, there's closure in the world. There is a reality that people die. That's a reality. And that sometimes that we think that we can outlive the Malach HaMavet. And that's not psychologically and educationally, that's something that we have to be very careful not to tamper with.
I think that should be the grandparents' decision.
I think that many people can disagree with you. But
well, Rav Gidon, thank you very much for your time, okay?
Always a pleasure to speak to you. I hope that, as I said, all these questions should be just in the Beis Midrash and shouldn't be in the hospital house, in hospitals and in people's houses, and we should only hear Bezrat Hashem good news, and Bezrat Hashem should we have children in a regular way, Bezrat Hashem.
Amen. Kol tov.
Be well. Kol tov. Bye-bye.